So I'm just going to bring the fearlessness practice in. Fear is here. So I want to dedicate this talk to my teacher, my precious teacher, Sangharakshita. Yeah. So I believe that humanity is basically one. I believe that it's possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being, to feel for any other human being, to be friends with any other human being. This is what I truly and deeply believe. This belief is part of my own experience. It's part of my own life. It's part of me. I cannot live without this belief, and I'd rather die than give it up. To me, to live means to practice this belief. So you're probably familiar with these words. So these words are the words of Bhante, and they were given at a talk in Bombay in 1983, I believe, talking to Mahamati, he was there, to about 4,000 followers of Dr. Ambedkar on why he was a Buddhist. And these were the words that were near the entrance up on the wall as I entered the Colchester Buddhist Centre about 20 years ago. And I remember reading them, and there was a part of me that really resonated with them. But then there was a bigger part of me that found it really painful to read. It wasn't my experience at all. In fact, I had one friend at that time, which is a bit weird to think of that. And yeah, I was painfully disconnected from people and from human beings. I'd fallen out with quite a few people. I was a single parent of a four-year-old child. And as a good friend reminded me recently, when she first met me, I was fixed in anger. So I'd grown up in conditions. They weren't always easy. And, you know, my parents, I'm sure they were doing their best to navigate life and to also, you know, navigate their own suffering. And what that meant is that I eventually became quite brittle and fiercely independent. So I didn't need anybody. I didn't want to sort of have to need anybody. And my reaction to life was mostly fight or flight, which of course is what we do. So my flight would mean sort of hedonism, using alcohol or drugs to soften the edges. And the opposite of that would mean fight. So I would blame, polarize, and at worst, I would get into fights. And my explosive anger meant that at 18 years old, I found myself in a pivotal moment being arrested after a fight in a pub. And I found myself sitting in a police cell, feeling ashamed and knowing in my heart of hearts that this wasn't really me and this wasn't the life that I wanted to live. But I also had no idea how I could change that. And I had no vision or anyone in my life to show me anything different. In fact, I remember, you know, just feeling like this is me, this is who I am, this is my life. And in a way, I was just a victim of my conditioning. So 10 years later, I very fortunately found myself walking into the Colchester Buddhist Centre. And I met the Sangha Jewel, and I met people doing their best to live out that vision of the Sangha Jewel, living out the vision of spiritual friendship. Just saw someone that was there. Yeah. And the most important thing that I learned at that time was a magical practice called the Metta Bhavana. So fast forward another 10 years, and I found myself surrounded by police again. But this time I'm Sanghamani, and I'm attending a faith day at Essex Police Headquarters, and I'm leading them through this magical practice of the Metta Bhavana. And for those that lead meditation spaces, you kind of have this moment sometimes where you look around the room and you get the sense where people are in the zone and people are with you. And I look round the room and there's all these different ranking police officers. And I just thought, they're in the zone. And then I thought, how the hell did this happen to my life? How did I get here? Yeah. So anyway, transforming through Sangha. Yeah, so I think it was in November, so it was at the end of Bhante's funeral. I was part of the vigil team with Aparajita, who's right here. And he asked me if I'd give this talk. And my first inner response was like, no, I don't give big talks, you know. I prefer to just work with teams and people. And then I said, oh, what's the theme? And he said, it's transforming through Sangha. And I was like, oh, I can't say no to that, can I? So here I am. In a way, I couldn't say no. It's my life. It was why my name was given to me. And also, it's how I practice the Dharma. Yeah. So firstly, what is transformation in Buddhism? So it's seeing through this belief that we are a fixed, separate, unchanging me, to knowing in our deepest hearts that we're part of this mysterious, boundless, interconnected flow of life. And the alchemical process is the path. And to do this work, we need a vision. And this vision is the bodhicitta, the awakening heart-mind. And we need to transform ourselves according to this vision. And that best takes place in relationship with others. Because it's really hard to do this transformative work alone, even if you've had a really profound insight experience. We need other people. We need other people. Sangha can also be the place where you can have those deeper seeings and those insights. And it can happen through spiritual friendship, through working together, through communication. And to explore transformation through Sangha, I'm going to use the metaphor of a pearl and talk about a handful of what I've experienced are the alchemical conditions that can open us up to this interconnected flow of life. And when preparing for this talk, I Google comes in, doesn't it? And I discovered something really exciting that in the Tibetan tradition, one of the images for the bodhicitta is the luminous pearl. And as you probably know, that pearls are formed by a piece of grit. So let's say the shell of the oyster is the Sangha. So it's its relationship. So it's the conditions that we live out and transform this vision. It holds shared teachings, ethical boundaries, a common language to be able to communicate and describe our inner experience, and a place where we can be held and our journey of transformation witnessed. And what's crucial is that it's a place that we meet each other. It's a place where our habits, our views, our conditioning becomes conscious and is reflected back. And Bhante, of course, has emphasized for us the value of spiritual friendship and says that we get to know ourselves in relationship to others. And this work of transformation is not easy. And sometimes it can be joyful and inspiring and beautiful. And sometimes it can be messy and uncomfortable. But we need each other to do this. And most importantly, we need metta. He's also emphasized the importance of commitment and bringing more and more of ourselves to the Dharma life, so that any step along the way, from showing up to meditation classes or the process of joining the order, we can deepen our practice. And sometimes I like to think of the institutions of Tri Ratna a bit like Bhante's esoteric hidden teachings. And whether that's we're in groups or in meetings, it's like what happens? We think we're just going to a meeting, and what actually happens? It's a bit like we're entering a hall of mirrors and we're being reflected back. So Sangha is a path, and a path that asks us to become intimate with ourselves and others on the basis of metta, where there's a mutual receptivity and appreciation, where we allow ourselves and each other to be changed, to change and to be changed. So we allow ourselves and each other to change and to be changed. And of course, this goes without saying, this needs to be imbued with ethical awareness. We need to take care of each other. So it's also a place where we become more and more inclusive of others and less tied to our own narrow self-interest. And I specifically want to talk about metta as a turning towards and an opening movement of consciousness. So in Sangha, what we're trying to do is to relate to each other on the basis of our potential for transformation. And maybe we just need to trust that a bit more and remember that. I was really moved hearing Sadanandi last night read Bhante's postcard that he'd sent her. And he said, there is no spiritual friendship without trust. I think it really moved me, really resonate with that. So in doing so relating to each other on this potential for transformation, what we're doing is activating the conditions for the awakening heart-mind. And I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about Karuna appeals, because that's my life. That's been the biggest context for transformation for me. And I just want to share that with you. So I've been doing this for 6 years. I've been participating in and helping to create the conditions for people to practice the Dharma intensively. And they're fundraising appeals. If you haven't heard of them before, we use them as a spiritual practice in Sri Ratna. And I'd say they're one of the most intensive contexts that we offer. And I've felt myself and others transform significantly because of them. In fact, last year, someone described doing an appeal as rocket fuel for the Dharma life, which I quite liked. So what's really interesting is they're known for not being easy. But that doesn't stop people. There's a sort of faith response to it. They're not easy, but people, they choose to do it. They go beyond themselves and choose to do it. And people sign up. And what's really interesting is you get people that do appeals, and it's been really challenging. And then at the end, we do like this feedback form. And one of the questions is, would you do it again? And they're like, yes. And I just think, wow, people are amazing. You know, there's something in it that they really get and really want. Yeah. Actually, I'm interested how many people here have done one. Put your hand up if you've done an appeal. Ah. Okay. Keep your hand up if you've done two. Wow. Three? Oh, wow. Four? Okay. You don't just get stripes, you get a medal. Yeah, good. Of course, Karuna appeals aren't the only way to practice the Dharma intensively, and not everyone can choose to do them. Yeah. And what I'm going to talk about is translatable in what you're already doing. And the important condition, I think, is commitment and choosing and knowing what conditions will take you deeper in your practice. And then when you know that, just doing it, just really choosing to do that, put yourself in those conditions. This is the crucible of the shell. And of course, those other conditions, you know, I think practicing in a family context has definitely been another one of my big conditions that have helped me grow. The arts, community living, work, supporting your Sangha to grow, they're all good conditions. So what is Karuna? It was really good to hear the social work in India mentioned yesterday. So we've been going for nearly 40 years, Karuna, we're a trust. So we're one of Sri Ratna's longest standing team-based right livelihoods. And what we do is fund grassroots projects that support transformation. It helps change lives and ends inequality and discrimination in India and Nepal to some of the most discriminated communities in the world. And it's for people, some people literally do live in hell realms. Yeah. And we do this through education. This transformation happens through education, gender equality, and helping people have dignified livelihoods. So it's really excellent work. And the way we raise that money, or most of it, 80% of it, is through Karuna fundraising appeals, door-to-door appeals or telephone campaigns. So the first thing to say is it's not really about fundraising. That's just what we call it. What you need here is a willingness to put yourself in good conditions to practice the Dharma. And the reasons they're good conditions is that, as I said earlier, you give yourself six weeks of that, of your life, you give yourself to it and you commit to that. And that creates this crucible. And you go out either calling people, or we don't go out and call people, but you go out and knock on doors night after night, door after door for 6 weeks, or you're calling people up on the phone. And what that means is you have to consistently go beyond yourself, because it's just not easy. Pranikata, you know, you did one last year. Yeah, it's just not easy. And what that helps to do is you really get to deepen your awareness. But within this, you really need to be willing to meet yourself and others fully in your entirety. Yeah. And then what we're learning to do is really take responsibility for your mind habits and how you relate to your experience. And all the support of that are things, you know, we up the ethical practice, the communication, the positive emotion practice, things like rejoicing in merits, ritual, transferring merits, generosity practice in the community. All of these conditions really help do the transformative work. But I think there's something about working in a team together means that you're part of something much more than just you. And the most important condition is that you're doing it to benefit others. So what these practices do, they help you to expand your point of self-reference, to go out to and be aware of others. And of course, this is an aspect of metta. And on appeals, you really get to know your base metals. So Ratnaguna talked about the base metals of greed, hatred, and delusion in the alchemical process. And what we discover is the way that our greed, hatred, and delusion, all our habits and our patterns, our personal psychology, our life history plays itself out in the world. You know, it's the same stuff that we do in life, but sometimes we just kind of miss it in life. So it's a really kind of intensified seeing of that. And what I see happen is that through all these practices and conditions, a journey of authentic connection with yourself and others happens. A couple of important elements, I think, are that you get reflected back, but also there's constant feedback. I mean, in a way, it's the same thing, isn't it? And that's what helps this awareness to grow and deepen. Yeah, I just want to recommend a culture of feedback, actually, if you're not doing it in your centre or in your GFR group or in your study group. I really recommend you bringing that in. I think it's really helpful. And of course, it's a practice in itself to do that well. Yeah. Bear with me. So I'm going to talk about the relationship of difference. So those that have done appeals, especially over the last few years, will probably recognize what I'm talking about. So this, of course, is the self-other divide. There's a you out there, and there's a me in here. Well, of course, you're all going to recognize that. This is what we do, isn't it, as human beings? Yeah. us at the center of things. And what we do is learn to recognize this relationship of difference. And it's really heightened when you knock on a door or call up a supporter on a phone. Because, funnily enough, people generally don't want you knocking on their doors or calling them up when they're in the middle of putting their kids to bed or making their supper or they've just got in from work. So that sets up these conditions already. They're not always ready to welcome you into their lives. That can be a bit awkward, but it creates these conditions. Yeah, so you get a really strong sense of subject-object experience, and you can end up feeling very solid and separate. And what we're trying to do is recognize that happening and then not react out of it. And what's really interesting is that we're learning to ease into this tension, into this separation. And if you can do that with awareness and with curiosity and with empathy, it's really lovely what can happen. It's like the separateness dissolves. And when we create space in ourselves, it's easier to respond to what's really alive and not overlay the experience with our wants and our assumptions and our expectations, because this creates disconnection and separateness. So I'm sure you can all relate to this just in your everyday lives. So I'm going to read a snippet from, in the summer we had a telephone campaign. A young woman called Frances, she wrote a blog afterwards. I just want to share it with you, a couple of paragraphs. It was very lovely what she wrote, and I think she really kind of captures what it's like. So she says, "What I do want to describe for me, which feels like the heart of this work, is the beautiful synergy that was woven between three different worlds. My world as a team of volunteers, a supporter's world at the end of the phone line, and the world in which the projects take place in India. Developing a deepening awareness of each of these simultaneously permitted a subtle yet profound alchemy to take place. And the emphasis that was placed on authentic connection was the key to all of this. Letting my guard down with our team of volunteers gave me the confidence to let myself be seen, to show my vulnerability and be open to people's responses to that. And this meant feeling and accepting discomfort and just sitting with it. And the more I became aware of what was happening in my body and on a physical and emotional level, the more I was able to open up. Self-compassion through awareness increased my ability to feel real compassion towards the people we were fundraising for and for those that we were asking for funds from. At times I felt so in touch for the people for whom we were fundraising that any money I raised brought forth real tears of joy. And the generosity of the supporters did the same. What I discovered was that so many people want to give. And my role felt like one of reconnecting them with that sense of compassion." So we have this shell, and then we have the grit that makes the pearl. So one of my favorite quotes from Bhante is that jewels are produced only by the collision of immense forces. Jewels are produced only by the collision of immense forces. I get that. So to do an appeal, you're basically choosing to enter the flames of intensity. And personally, I found that some of my strongest insights happen when in intensity. And there's a focus that it brings that helps us to see things more deeply. You could say that doing an appeal is a bit like fast-forwarding 5 years of Dharma practice. I certainly felt it to be as significant as my ordination retreat. Yeah. And I've heard a number of order members say that, actually. So you're choosing to be seen, and you're choosing to get instant feedback from the doors and from the team. And you'll meet yourself, you'll meet your habits, your views, your fears, and all the ways in which your ego project manifests. But what that also does, it also grows your potential for connection, for love, for generosity, and for awareness. And it's not easy. And the Buddha reminds us that it's important to get to know the experience of dukkha or discomfort. And not in an intellectual way, but in our direct experience, as it's felt in the body and the heart. Dukkha, as it's known in Buddhist circles, is the grittiness of life. And it's also what happens when we resist how things are. So what we need to do is to learn to turn towards experience with awareness and metta and meet it with openness, rather than contracting and disconnecting from life. And being able to meet dukkha and meet it with metta is a doorway to equanimity. I've got a bit of a practice. I am quite lucky. I do get quite a lot of dukkha in my life. And over the last few years, I get this practice where I try and recognize it happening. And I just say, this is what dukkha feels like, Sanghamani. I just say it out loud just to try and remind myself. So what I see on appeals is people going deeper with themselves and others. And that deepening, of course, isn't always easy, but it's almost essential for authentic connection to happen. And I think we can spend a lot of our energy and lives avoiding discomfort. And I don't think that's always helpful, because the path of freedom isn't about getting comfortable. Yeah, I have to remind myself of that. I quite like my home comforts. So practicing the Dharma isn't also about always being nice. And on appeals, we say, we've got this saying, which some of you might recognize, a nice Buddhist is a dead Buddhist. Yeah, bear with me, don't leave. Hang on. And what that means is that we're not trying to overlay our experience with an idea of how we think we should be or what we think we should be experiencing. Yeah? So, for example, you knock on a door, someone's mean to you, and you stand there and you keep smiling and saying sorry, whilst in fact what's really going on is that you're feeling hurt, upset, and a bit frustrated. So what that doesn't mean, I just want to be really clear about that, is that you then spill that all out onto someone else. It doesn't mean that. But what it means is that we really need to be able to acknowledge what's really going on in our experience. That's the material that we're practicing the Dharma from, not what we think should be going on. Yeah. So we're trying to acknowledge our entire experience rather than ignore it. And what helps is allowing space to feel those direct sensations in the body. And from that, the associative story that we might be interpreting and believing. Last week, we had an order convention. And I was really happy to hear Prakasha, who gave the main talks. He spoke about for enlightenment to happen, we need to be willing to integrate the shadow. And I felt very moved hearing that. Yeah. Or else it just keeps playing out. And what that then does, it just keeps us separate and suffering. And shining the light of metta on our shadows will help transform them. And of course, this is the work of Padmasambhava, who transforms the demons through seeing with love. Because if we're not doing that, what we're doing is spiritual bypassing. And in the long run, it's just not going to work, because transformation isn't going to really happen. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is take full responsibility for our entire experience, including all the uncomfortable bits. So I'm just going to share with you a story from my recent telephone campaign. And there was a guy on the appeal who's fairly new to Dharma practice. So he met quite a lot of himself. And so a big part of the work we do on appeals is checking in. We create conditions for this awareness to deepen. And so it was near the end of the appeal. And we all sat down And I just noticed his energy. He just wasn't there. He wasn't with us. It's like he disappeared. It's like the shutters had gone up. And then when asked in the group, you know, how are you? What's going on? He had a version of what was going on, but it didn't quite add up. And what was really beautiful is then we just got into a bit of dialogue, which also included some body awareness and just helping him to get into his body and to really try and create the space to be more intimate with what was really going on. And what he discovered, he was kind of talking it out, sort of taking us on that journey. And what he got to this place where he described in his belly was this black box of anger. And through being with that and staying with it and being able to just hold it with metta, it just started to dissolve. And he was sharing this experience with the team. And what was really beautiful is that the more he was connecting with himself, the more he was connecting with us. But also there'd been this disconnect with the team, and then the more the team connected with him. In fact, one of the people who's here today, he also acknowledged that it helped him to arrive more into the room. And it was really beautiful to see that happen. So through doing that, he came into relationship with others. And rather than remaining separate, he was in connection. So going deeper in relationships isn't always easy. So we've got the grit. And it doesn't have to be, it's good to remember, it doesn't have to be comfortable. Relationships aren't always comfortable. And it's also worth remembering, it doesn't always mean there's something wrong when it's not comfortable. Yeah, because we can go so easily to aversion, can't we? Or horrified anxiety or fixing and all of that stuff. But what it can be is an opportunity to see dukkha more deeply, and ultimately it can be a doorway to freedom. So then we have the pearl, the luminous pearl. So it's through this alchemical process, allowing our awakening hearts to meet the world with openness and to see things as they are, we become a vessel for the bodhicitta. So this is the vision. So what does that mean for us in terms of transforming Sangha? So Bhante reminds us that metta is not about fixing on any single point of identity. And what that means is that we see each other as process. And that includes all our contradictions, our imperfections, our mistakes. But also it means seeing the potential for all our beautiful qualities and our spiritual victories. It means seeing it all. And what happens is that we can grow a heart that forgives, and we see each other without fixing or polarizing. What a gift that would be. So it's about trusting this process. So I just want to share one of my favorite quotes with you. It's from The Little Prince. Oh, yeah. And he says, "It's only with the heart can one see that which is invisible to the eye." Yeah. So it's not easy, is it? And it's not easy, especially when our fight or flight is triggered. And I just want to share one more, there is another story, but I'll just share this story. It's an experience I had on a Karuna appeal. And it's a story of meeting suffering on the door in Manchester. So some of you have probably heard this story. This is one of my favourites. Bear with me. So part of the training on appeals in the development of awareness is so you don't just sort of go around running, knocking on doors like supermarket sweep. You kind of arrive at a house, at a door, and you have to really land and sort of take in what you're picking up. You know, what does the house communicate? What's going on for you? And then so that when you knock on the door, there's a lot more space for you to be able to have that connection. Anyway, I didn't do that. So I knocked on this door. And as I knocked, I looked in this little window to the side of the door, and it said something like, "Hawkers, religious fanatics, beggars, salesmen, knock on my door and experience my wrath. I got to the end of that and the door slowly opening, and I won't tell you what word came into my mind first, but I was like, okay, there's a moment here. I either stay with my fear, my fight or flight, or I just run. So, and I stayed with it. I remembered my training. I grounded. I breathed into my fear. I knew that I was kind of ready to run. But I just created enough space within that. And this door opened, and it was like it wasn't really opened by a human being. It was more like my first impression was like, you know, in a Japanese anime animation, like you've got these monsters, these big dark monsters. It was like his energy was grey and dark and like, rah, you know. And he just seemed like a monster. He didn't even seem human. And I remember thinking, oh dear. Anyway, came back into my body, and I thought, I've either got to talk very quickly or I've got to get out of here. And so I just looked at him and I just said, had I seen this, had I read it before I knocked on your door, I wouldn't have knocked on your door, trying to talk my way out of it. So I think what that did is acknowledge what was really there. You know, I'd kind of made a mistake. I wouldn't have chosen to do that. And So he looked at me, I looked at him, I'm still trying to breathe and relax. And he kind of like took a breath, and then he went through gritted teeth and really kind of like vibrating with anger, I don't like people knocking on my door. And then he went, and that's the nicest way I've ever said that. You know, my impression of nice wasn't quite that kind of energy, yeah? But because I kind of created this space within myself, something turned around. So I was in touch with my fear, I was in touch with my aversion. But what I realized, I sort of breathed into my heart, and I just thought, oh. And I had this moment of almost like thinking, this is how the Buddha was seen. Obviously that didn't happen in that moment, but in reflection, I thought, oh, this maybe is what the Buddha would do. And I just suddenly, I didn't see him as personally attacking me. It was more like I had no idea about his history and what conditions had led him to this moment in his life, being so full of anger and hate and pain. And it's like I just saw that. I sort of dropped away this idea that I was being kind of, that I was under attack or something. And I just saw his pain, and something in me relaxed. And there was this moment, and I just said to him, well, I knew that this for him was an act of generosity. And I really was then speaking to that, and I just said, thank you. And then I said, because I just want you to know. No, I said, thank you, and thank you for being kind. And I just really wanted to recognize his kindness. I said, because I want you to know it's a bit scary doing this, and sometimes it's not easy. And it was like we'd both found connection. I'd allowed myself to come in, he'd allowed himself to come in, and there was this beautiful, very small connection, and that was it. And then he just shut the door. No, before he shut the door, his eyes welled up with tears, and then he shut the door. And even though he shut the door in my face, I felt so grateful, and I walked away from that door feeling like that's one of my best ever doors. And that is one of my best experiences of metta that I think I've had. Yeah. So yeah, there's something about being able to create the space, isn't there, for reactions and for empathy, from that space for empathy and metta to come. So on Karuna appeals, after going through quite a gritty process sometimes, not everyone, but some people, what I see is people start to glow and shine like luminescent pearls. And at its best, a Karuna appeal team can become a bit like a field of living meta. I think I feel like that's what we're becoming, actually. We're starting to move into that space. Yeah. And there's this connectedness and awareness of each other, which is Sangha at its best. And I had a really tangible experience of this in the vigil and the time running up to Bante's funeral, where everybody here was just working together in this beautiful flow, and everything that needed to get done got done. And it was, I just remember feeling that this is it, this is Sangha, you know, this is the vision, this is what we're working towards. So I want to talk about the brave hearts. Teams, they give themselves these names, that's their vision. It's interesting, isn't it, that a lot of it's about heart. Well, not a lot of it. There's a team actually doing an appeal, a men's team in London at the moment. They've called themselves the Laughing Ninjas of Fire, which I think is a brilliant name. Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to talk about the Brave Hearts. So last year I was on a telephone campaign with the Brave Hearts, and what I saw happen is they became more than their individual selves. And what got that to happen is that they were willing to reveal themselves to each other. And that involved them being able to meet and reveal their vulnerability and trust each other with this. And then out of this, it was almost like they became a brave heart rather than these individual brave hearts. And it was just so beautiful. And from that place, they raised a lot of money. So that was interesting that that happened, and then they raised a lot of money for Karuna. So it's so beautiful witnessing people slowly unfold and open. Yeah. And then that gap between self and other, it becomes less tangible and solid. And when this happens on a team, this effect can often mean that the universe meets them, and then this kind of magic happens. For those that have done appeals, you probably got your own stories in some way, but I'm going to share with you a story of magic. This has happened so many times, but I'm going to share Akasa Jyoti's story. Hope I've got the facts right, but I think it's kind of almost there. So she was in Birmingham, and I think around this particular time on the appeal, it might have been the grit was there, and fear possibly was there. And so I remember she did an invocation to a Moga city to try and help before she went out, and then did quite a lot of chanting of the mantra during the night. And normally on appeals, you have particular roads that we ask you to knock, but she was drawn to this house, which wasn't necessarily on her map, and she just knew she wanted to knock there, and so she did, which was very naughty. But it wasn't really. And I can't really remember the conversation, but basically, she met a man, and the conversation ended with him giving her a statue of a Moga city that she brought home to the team. And that's happened not just once on appeals. And on one appeal in particular, the guy didn't even know it was anything to do with Buddhism, anything to do with Green Tara. And this Danta Chitta, who was on this appeal, came back with a Green Tara for our appeal. It was just bonkers. Yeah. So yeah, magic can happen. So the grit in the oyster becomes the pearl and helps us awaken if we can meet it with metta. And the more we can listen deeply with our own hearts, with compassion, we can cross the bridge of separation and reflect each other's beauty like luminescent pearls in a golden net. And it's then that our capacity to meet the cries of the world becomes deep and boundless. And that's alchemy. Thank you.